Well, good morning. Hope you guys had a great Christmas celebration yesterday, and y'all made it back this morning, braved the cold weather, got here. That's really incredible. We're excited to be back together to continue our celebration of Christmas. We just had a great time yesterday. All the kids are home, which we know every year for us is going to be less and less probable. And just the opportunity to be together, to read the Christmas story together, to get out the birthday cake and candle for Jesus and to sing happy birthday to Jesus, and then open presents and spend the day with family. And just a fantastic time. And Christmas Day is kind of like that. It's just kind of a special day. And I don't know what your day was like, but today's the day after Christmas. And so I'm assuming you guys are here because you're the ones who are smart enough not to purchase some assembly required. Or maybe you did and you just needed to get away from the house. And so this is your sanity this morning. Well, oftentimes I fear that we have a misconception of the Christian life. We come to the celebration of Christmas, and it's such a wonderful day. And we begin to think that really the Christian life ought to be Christmas Day every day. That really what Christianity is all about is having that warm feeling of hope, that Christianity is all about receiving daily gifts from God, presents that God sends our way, that the Christian life is about having real harmony and just celebration, that kind of every morning ought to be Christmas morning. And what we fail to recognize at times is Christianity is not recognizing that Christmas is the end of the hope. It's actually the beginning of the hope. And hope that's realized is not really hope at all, Paul says in Romans. So really we have to come to grips with the fact that we are still hoping for something that hasn't fully developed. It hasn't fully come. It's the kingdom of God, that's what we're looking for. And so along the way, every day will not be Christmas Day. There's the day after Christmas. This morning, I want us to actually look at part of the Christmas story. And as we look at part of the Christmas story, we're going to recognize that for the people that were close to Jesus Christ, life was not that easy. In fact, as you open your Bibles to the book of Matthew, we're going to take a look at chapter 2 of the book of Matthew. We're going to find that Christmas Day is really one moment of celebration in a lifetime of struggle and opposition. That Christmas morning, that Christmas Day, that's a moment of celebration, but it's really a lifetime struggle. And as we look at the life of Jesus Christ, I think that's more reflective of what we will experience as believers, as Christ followers, than what we think we experience on Christmas morning. Rather than me reading the story this morning, I thought it would be good for us to watch the story. And so we're going to watch a dramatization of Matthew chapter 2. The narrator in the story is Matthew himself, pictures Matthew telling the story of what took place. And in order to really get the full feel of what happened in the aftermath of the birth of Jesus, I want you to see it for yourself. So let's just watch this passage read out in dramatization.
After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked,
"Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him."
When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born.
"In Bethlehem, in Judea,"
they replied.
For this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be shepherd of my people, Israel. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared.
He sent them to Bethlehem and said,
"Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him."
After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you. For Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. Gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. And what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. The voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. Thank you. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel. For those who are trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there.
Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went to live in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets: he will be called a Nazarene.
So the story of Christmas is not just a story of the birth of Jesus, it's not just a story of the Magi, but it's also a story of Herod. It's not just a story of rejoicing and joy. It's also a story of struggle and of hardship and of tragedy. And as we look at the story of the Magi, we recognize that it's probably a little different than what is typically portrayed in our nativity scenes. In fact, the implications of Scripture is that when Jesus was born, the star appeared. Now, for the Magi to travel to the place where the star appeared probably took them about 6 months. It could have taken them up to 2 years because Herod, wanting to make sure that he killed the Christ, the Messiah, he killed all the baby boys up to 2 years. So there was a period of time between the time that Jesus was born and the time that the Magi actually got there. In addition to that, the text says that Jesus was not in a stable. He was actually in a house at this time. And you might say, well, that's so weird because, you know, why do we then kind of put the shepherds and the Magi together in the nativity scene? And you know, the answer is pretty simple. I mean, think about how hard it would be to have two nativity scenes. Get two sets of decorations out, you know, have the baby being, you know, a baby and then being a little toddler. No, throughout history, that people have just kind of lumped this event together as one event, but it's really two separate events. And so the Magi show up and they're asking, and they travel the 5 miles that it takes to get to Bethlehem. And the implication in the passage, if you start in verse 13, it says, "When they had gone, the angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, 'Get up, take the child and his mother, escape to Egypt, stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child and kill him.' So he got up, took the child during the night and left for Egypt and stayed there until the death of Herod." The period of time between the time that the Magi would have had this conversation with Herod and then made the 5-mile trip to Bethlehem, spent that time together worshiping and then leaving, and then Herod coming to attack or kill the children, could have been as short as a 48-hour period. So when it says that an angel appeared to Joseph in a dream and woke him up and said, "Get up and get out of there," that probably means that they had that visit from the Magi, and the next night, Joseph is being told to take the baby and go to Egypt. Now, this trip to Egypt would appear to be a significant hardship on Mary. So can you imagine, you know, ladies, you get your husband wakes you up in the night and says, "I just had a dream. And we're supposed to get on the donkey again, and we're supposed to travel 75 miles to Egypt, to the border. Once we get to the border, it's another 100 miles to Alexandria, where the big Jewish colony is, where we're going to live. And we're going to do this because Herod's going to kill our baby. And I dreamed this all last night." Now, I don't know how many of you guys have traveled in a minivan with a baby. I don't know how many of you have traveled a great distance after having given birth 6 months before. But Jesus' family experienced significant hardship right after Christmas, right after his birth. Not to mention that in the process of that, Herod, who was one of the most evil men that's ever lived on this planet, he executed a plot to try to make sure that Jesus Christ didn't survive. Now, Herod had a reputation for killing people. He killed one of his wives. He killed three of his sons. He killed his mother-in-law, if you can imagine that. In fact, there was such a reputation about Herod's butchery of even his own family that one of the writers of the day said that it's safer to be Herod's pig than it is to be one of his sons, because his pig would have a better chance of living longer than his sons. Herod was so hated by the people that he ruled over that he was afraid no one would mourn him at his death. And so you know what he did? He trumped up a bunch of charges against some of the most prominent people in Jerusalem and had given his soldiers orders that they were to be executed on his death so that the city would send up mourning so it would feel like people were actually mourning him, because he knew nobody would be mourning him. Now, fearing that there was a rival king that had just been born in Bethlehem, he sends his soldiers to Bethlehem to kill all of the baby boys that are 2 years old and down. He wants to make sure that whenever that star appeared, that the child's going to be killed. Now, the number of kids in Bethlehem, in that town about that age, the number of boys could have been anywhere from 10 to 20. So it wasn't thousands and thousands of children. It was a small community, but the pain of the loss of those children in a small community is overwhelming. In fact, the prophet compares it to the deportation of Israel. Notice in verse 17, it says, "Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." He's quoting Jeremiah chapter 40, which was the prediction of the captivity of Israel. And Ramah was a city from where the Babylonians staged the deportation of the young people. So when the Babylonians came in and captured the nation of Israel, took over Judah, they brought the young people to Ramah, and from there they set them up to be deported. Now, some of you guys from your history think that there was only one time in history where the Jews were treated this way. Well, there are multiple times, but it wasn't just in Nazi Germany. They had the same thing under the Babylonians. They herded them all up and they deported them. And the picture in this passage is that the mothers would be weeping for their children. Now, Rachel, who's the mother of the 12 tribes, one of the two women that brought the 12 tribes in the world, she's pictured as the mother of all mothers. And she's weeping for her kids as they go into captivity. And this passage says that as sad as that day was, this day was equally sad, that from the grave, the mother of Israel is weeping for these children who are killed at the birth of the Messiah. This was a terrible, terrible time. And so Jesus' family takes him off to Egypt. The kids there are massacred. And finally, Herod dies. And again, the angel appears and says to come back home. So in verse 19, after Herod died, the angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, he took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judah, or Judea, in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to a district of Galilee. So he went to live in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, "He will be called a Nazarene." Jesus now makes the trip back, only he doesn't settle in Bethlehem. He doesn't settle in Jerusalem because one of Herod's sons is still on the throne. There's still a threat. He goes up to Nazareth, a small community where he will be in kind of incognito. Nobody will really know who he is, where he came from. They won't associate him with what took place in Bethlehem. And really, there's this threat going all the way back to the birth that if it ever gets found out by the family of Herod who Jesus actually is, that he's going to live his young life under this threat until Herod's family really kind of gets this out of their mentality. This is a life of hardship. Now, some people would say, you know, I don't know. Like, why bring up kind of the bad news? You know, isn't life hard enough as it is without bringing up bad news? Shouldn't we just kind of think and focus on the positive? You know, there's a real risk in life, if you just think and focus on the positive. If we as people deny the reality of the difficulty in life, we can adopt in our mentality, we kind of start thinking that life ought to always be easy. There shouldn't be a struggle. There shouldn't be any hardships. If we really love God, everything ought to go our way. And so the tendency then is whenever there's conflict or difficulty or hardship, we look at God and we say, God, what's wrong with you? And we push away from God. God, you're letting me down. God, you're not coming through. God, you're not there for me. And really, in the midst of hardship, that's the time when we need to draw closest to God. And wouldn't it be sad if we misunderstood what life looks like, what the Christian life looks like, what the hardship and realities of life really are. And so we expect them to be different. And when they come in hard, we actually pull back from the one that we need to draw closest to. I don't know about you today. Maybe you've experienced that before, where you had expectations that God would give you the job or give you the girl or give you the house or give you the iPad, and it didn't happen. Maybe you expected that God would maintain your health or maintain your joy, that God would maintain your standard of living, and it's not working out that way. And you're looking up at God and saying, God, this isn't what I expected. I expected when I put my trust in you that every day would be Christmas Day and every morning would be Christmas morning. And the tendency at that time is to pull back from God rather than to lean into God. Whenever a pilot is being trained to fly, what do? They take the pilot, they put the pilot in a flight simulator. Inside that flight simulator, they begin to teach the pilot through physical, visual experience what it's like to fly a plane. And once the pilot gets a handle on what it's like to fly a plane, then they begin to throw bad scenario after bad scenario after bad scenario at the pilot so the pilot can learn how to handle that plane in all kinds of different situations. Engine goes out, bad weather, wind shear. Now, we might be thinking, airlines, why would you do that? We don't want pilots to experience that kind of stuff. It may make them nervous. Like, they may start feeling when they come into the cockpit, oh, what if something goes wrong today? So, you know, in order to maintain their positive outlook and their happy spirit, what we want to do is only give them situations that are positive. You say, Tim, that would be crazy. I don't want to fly with a person that's never experienced any difficulty. I want them to be able to know how to handle themselves in those situations. And that's very true. And for us to think that we will waltz through life and that God will never allow a situation to cross our path that's hard, that kind of fantasy, that kind of dream world, that's not reality. Christmas Day, as great as it is a foretaste of the kingdom of God. And in between, there's going to be a lot of struggle and a lot of hardship. You say, well, is there any help along the way? The answer to that is absolutely. In fact, in this passage, we see that God remains sovereign in the struggle. He's sovereign in the struggle, and he gives guidance in the fight. So God is not absent in these situations. He's actually in charge of these situations, and God gives guidance all along the way. I want you to see how this works. Notice in verses 15, 18, and 23, in each of these situations, there's a fulfillment of a prophecy. We notice in verse 15, it says that the trip to Egypt is so that out of Egypt I called my son. That's a prophecy that will be fulfilled. God is saying, I have this under control. I know my son's going to end up in Egypt. And I want you guys to know in advance that he's the real deal. He's the real thing. In verse 18, the mourning over the children being killed is prefigured in a prophecy in Jeremiah chapter 40. And then finally in verse 23, that he will be called a Nazarene. All along the way, God is protecting Jesus Christ by placing him where he needs to be at the right time to avoid the ugliness of what Herod is doing in order that we might even today be able to look back on those prophecies and know that God's in control. I don't know what's going to happen in your life in 2011. I have no idea, but you know who does? God knows. God knows. And if things go really good for you, God's in charge of that. He understands. If things go really bad, God's in charge of that. He knows. He knows what your life is going to unfold to look like. And you never have to wonder, like, what's God doing? Taking a nap? Is he on vacation? Is he partying with the angels? Like, I'm not getting anything. Is he lost touch with me? In fact, in Romans 8, verse 28, it tells us that God works all things together for good to those who love him, to those who are called according to his purpose. And in verse 29, it goes on to say that those who God foreknew, he also called. In other words, God entered into a relationship with us before the foundation of the world. He knew us in advance. And in knowing us in advance, God has been part of our lives from the beginning, and he will be till the end. We can count on God's sovereign hand through the hardships of life. The second thing that we can count on is God's guidance. God's guidance. God will always provide guidance for every situation that we face. In this passage, he gives guidance to the Magi. He gives them a star to follow. They get to Jerusalem, and the wise men of Jerusalem can actually look at the sacred scrolls and be able to say that God had the prophets write these places down so they knew he was going to Bethlehem. And then God warns them not to go back to Herod. So all along the way, he's guiding the Magi. In addition to that, God guides Joseph. Now, he does it in a rather unusual way. He does it in two different dreams. He appears to him in the dream and gives him a warning. Now, here's what's interesting to me. In verse 13, he tells him to get up and take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. And then in verse 14, what did Joseph do? So he got up. And then in verse 20 again, he says, get up in Egypt and take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel. In verse 21, it says, so he got up. Now, for me, the issue is not a lack of guidance. It's the get up part. Because here's what I would have done. Hey, just got these new gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. These guys are traveling from all over the world. My kid is a rock star. Now, I'm not sure what to do with the frankincense and the myrrh, but man, the gold's really good. And I'm laying in bed at night, and I'm having this dream, and this dream is telling me things aren't as good as you think. You need to get up and get out of here. And my tendency would have been, in that dream, to think, you've got to be kidding me. I'm going to tell this woman that we're going to get up and take our kid, and we're going to go out of this country. We're going to go be refugees in a country. How are we going to support ourselves? Who's going to pay the bills? How are we going to get there? What are we going to do for food? What are we going to do for diapers? What are we going to do with our medical insurance? I mean, how are we going to handle all this? You know what, God? I'm going to chalk that particular dream up to the pizza that I had right before I went to bed, or maybe it was too much pecan pie or something. I'm not going to do that. You see, my issue is not divine guidance, it's personal obedience. And in each of these cases, he gets up and he does what God tells him to do. Now, here's the promise. In James chapter 1, verse 5, God promises that if any of us lack wisdom, we can ask him and he will give us guidance. What I fear is that most of the time, the issue is not an issue of a lack of guidance. In fact, we've got the Bible. God wrote down what we need to know to do. It's not a lack of guidance, it's an unwillingness. You know, what I want to say is, God, listen, it would be much easier for me if you just fix the Herod issue. Like, you fix that. That's what you're there for. I'm just going to stay here. It's your deal. You fix it. If I have that attitude, what I'm doing is I'm assuming that every day in the Christian life is Christmas Day. I'm not recognizing that God has a plan that he wants to engage me in, and he will give us guidance for the journey. As we wrap up this Christmas season, and as we begin to move into the aftermath of this time, my prayer for each of us is that we recognize that there will be significant struggle and hardship that we will face in our life from now until the time that Jesus Christ returns and establishes his kingdom. That's normal. But for you and me, what we need to know is that God is never abandoning us. He's in control. He's moving this world in the right direction. The very fact that he sent his son into the world so that his son could pay the penalty for our sin, to rise from the dead, to promise a coming kingdom, all of that indicates that God is on track to accomplish his plan. And for those of us who put our faith in Jesus Christ, we get to be part of the good side of that plan. And yet, day by day in the struggles, God will be there to guide us if we listen and obey. Let's bow our heads and just take a moment to sit before our Father. With heads bowed, I would just ask you to ponder in your heart for a moment. Is there anything that is in my heart that I have bitterness, frustration toward God, disappointment today? I mean, honestly, before him, is there anything there that's holding me back from leaning fully into God? If there's something there, get it right this morning. Confess it to God. He's got a plan for you. He wants you to lean into that plan and look to him. We are broken. We are in need of help. We will struggle in this world, but God is there.